Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. I'm joined today by fellow human being, Michael Kester. And today we have two films about the beauty of humanity, really.
Absolutely. We're doing hard candy and funny games.
I guess I should just warn people right away. Normally I would never warn you before going into a film, but these aren't actually about the beauty of humanity.
Yeah.
This is a pretty cynical show compared to especially what we've been doing.
This is the kind of warning maybe we should have given last week and not right before we talk about the films that people have already watched.
If we made you watch Funny Games and Hard Candy and we didn't give you enough of a warning that these are kind of downers, I apologize. I don't want to bring anybody down. Go on YouTube and look at videos of cats. So give me some themes here before we do the spoiler nonsense, just so people know what we're getting into.
Well, the theme's kind of a general people hurting other people.
Yeah.
It's just a downer.
Awful, mean people.
Feeling bad and people not making. It's kind of a sad look at humanity.
It really is.
It's really what it is.
I always joke with you about when we want to end the show and never do another episode. We'll pair, like, I throw Funny Games out a lot. I'll say, you know, Funny Games and Happiness.
Right.
And then people will just never listen again. And most of the listeners will probably end their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
But we really did need to touch on Funny Games. And why not put it with Hard Candy? I'm going to warn people up front. This is double, triple, quadruple warning. So this episode also marks the return of Camera Chat.
Yeah.
A segment of Double Feature no one but me cares about. But I feel like it'll be a necessary break. We're going to talk about Hard Candy first. We're going to spoil things in Hard Candy. And there's a spoiler about Hard Candy's plot pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
So if you care about spoilers, you probably don't even want to listen to that. We have chapters in the feed because we're going to spoil Funny Games as well. So you could normally skip to Hard Candy or Funny Games. But if you get most of the way through Hard Candy and you notice I've started rambling on about cameras and lighting and set design, I'm probably going to continue doing that for a good 5 minutes, so you might just want to skip to Funny Games. Unless you need that nice little...
droning sound of Eric's voice to kind of separate you from the darkness.
All right, droning sound. That's fine. If you just need a division, if you need a partition between Hard Candy and Funny Games to take a quick breather, go out and have a smoke while your stereo is still running, that's what that'll be for. Hard Candy is a visual and maybe even audible masterpiece, but I really like Hard Candy because the two characters are pretty ambiguous.
Yeah.
You and I have talked about ambiguity and especially villains before.
Specifically,
sometimes villains can get very cookie cutter and mustache twirling, and it's nice to have a villain that's questionable. You don't really know if they're a hero or a villain. You have a pretty good idea that they're a villain, but they're not just a cutout. You know what I mean?
Right. They're not a comic book villain style.
Sure.
All out for evil.
And it's usually the best we can ask for is for our villains to have some sort of purpose. Although once we get to Funny Games, I'm sure we'll come right back to that idea. But in Hard Candy, we're not even really sure we have a villain. And as the movie goes on, we kind of realize we have two villains.
Yeah, it kind of just turns into the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
You're watching this film trying to decide, well, on one hand, this guy is a pedophile. On the other hand, this girl is torturing somebody.
Yes.
Where along the lines do my allegiances fall as to which is doing the less evil act?
Thought experiments. Yes, we've returned once again to thought experiments. But it's nice because you get to play thought experiments in an arena with a heightened sense of what you would believe is acceptable. Now, normally you or I would never condone torturing a person, but in cinema...
Ever.
Yeah, right. Ever condone torturing a person. But in cinema, that's the kind of thing where it's like the vigilante idea.
Yeah.
You know, people shouldn't be going out enforcing their own justice in the streets, but that's an acceptable thing to do in movies. So Hard Candy very gracefully pushes you to a point where you go, yes, in real life, I wouldn't be okay with this. This is not okay. I guess this is okay in a movie. You know what? This might not even be okay in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to the end, you're kind of questioning that on both levels. So let's start with our male lead first. I don't know about you, but I kind of bought this guy's story for most of the film.
Yeah.
At what point do you turn on him?
Well, honestly, I don't really ever turn on him.
Yeah.
But,
it's weird, isn't it?
I think
we're going to be unlike most people.
There comes a point in the film where she opens the safe,
mm-hmm.
and there's clearly some very upsetting photos in there.
Yes.
But what's upsetting to me is that I don't get to see them.
Yeah.
And so I don't know exactly where the level of upsetting comes in. I mean,
it upsets a 14-year-old girl.
But it's very possible that it's just the picture of that dead girl.
Right.
Or the missing girl. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that doesn't mean he's a culprit in any sense. It just means that he has a picture of some missing girl.
And part of my problem here is that I feel sometimes like I have too much faith in humanity. I'm too willing to just accept what a random person tells me and just trust another human being.
Yeah.
Because I like people and I trust them.
Well, in this film, the situation for anybody like you or myself who's more inclined to just believe that a person's a good person than a bad person is that the male's role is constantly defending himself as on his own merit and at his own word, where you get to see everything she's doing. You know she's doing it. It's proven on screen in front of you.
Yeah, her intentions are very clear.
All her bad deeds are happening. His are questioned the whole time.
They're all before the film started. They're all in the past. And the only person, and this is the beautiful part of only having two characters, the only person telling us about his bad deeds is the person who we have physical evidence is doing terrible things. Ellen Page's character, Haley, is the one presenting us with all of this information. She's also the one torturing a man on screen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's that questionable. I think most people will sit down, especially once the movie is complete. I think almost everyone would go, all right, this guy's a pedophile. He's a bad guy. But from the opening scene, I feel like the film's manipulating me. You have a really young girl and you have this older guy, and there's a lot of weird sexual tension, a lot of perversion. And I know the film is setting me up to go, that guy's a pedophile.
Yeah.
This girl is a poor, innocent girl. But once the film shows that Haley is a little bit smarter than she lets on, once we kind of see her plan, then I go back on that question. I go back on, well, the film wanted me to believe this, because part of that is buying into her innocence, right? And once you know that she's not quite as innocent, I think innocent is the right word. I mean, once you're torturing a person,
Or at least naivety.
Yes, sure. Once her intentions become clear, really, because that's why this isn't self-defense. That's why she showed up here. So they get to talking, and you think he's a bad guy, but you don't really know what level of bad guy he is, and then you get the pictures, and that's bad. And you might decide at that point that you're not okay with this man. He is not a good person. But then she starts to do some really sick shit to him.
Yeah.
And you don't know if you're all right with that either, and that's when you start to question her. And I think because there's a point where she's no longer the victim in the situation. She really has total control, and it's mostly his fault that she has control, but she has the control nonetheless.
Yeah, well, and there's never really a point throughout this entire film where she is the victim. She's representing the victim.
Sure.
She's kind of a vicarious victim, but she's never herself in danger. She throws herself in a dangerous situation knowing that she's going to take control of
it
and make a victim out of who otherwise would be the attacker.
Yes. The reason I like that, a lot of people will question that, because you can sit down and explain to a person that these characters are really deep and have a lot of stuff going on, and they'll basically shrug at you and go, okay, so what does that mean? Why is that? Who cares? And what's great about that is it makes for a much more natural and much more unpredictable story.
Mm-hmm.
When you have characters whose motivations aren't exactly clear, or who, more importantly, you don't know, you know, are the good guy or the bad guy. She's the protagonist in this movie. That's just how it's set up, and he's the antagonist. For better or for worse, you would agree with that dynamic, right?
I don't think in this situation...
You still don't think that's clear?
I have a really difficult time in a two-person film with this kind of ambiguity deciding who's the good guy and who's...
I guess that's my point.
Even within the realm of the film, they don't give you a tertiary view to kind of let you in on at least which one the film is even promoting.
You mean the minute and a half you see Sandra Oh, that's not enough for you to make your decision?
Enough.
Yeah, it's a constant guessing game you have to make back and forth the entire time you're watching. And ultimately, I don't know if you even get an answer until the very end. But the other thing that accomplishes is to make the viewer, as we'll talk again about in Funny Games, uncomfortable the whole time, because you're used to a dynamic where you're almost rooting for someone. Look at any of the films we've done, I don't know, ever. Most of them have heroes.
Right.
They have a person we are following, or a group of people we are following, and we want them to win. And sometimes you and I want them to suffer because right. that's just something different in films that needs to happen. But here we don't have anyone to root for, and it makes us uncomfortable. It makes people squirm. They don't know what they want out of this situation. They, you know, at first they want her to get out of the house, but you know by scene two that that's just a bad idea, yeah. her even being there. And she's not about to leave, clearly. So you have to accept the fact, you have to get out of denial, really, and you have to accept the fact that she's going to be in the house the entire time. Where do you go from there? And in your head, you always build these optimal situations, especially in horror films, all the time in horror films, where you go, how does the person get out? What do I want to happen? Do they need to bolt? Do they need to call the police? What's the best thing in your mind, or maybe out of your mouth if you live in Uptown, to shout at the screen for the character yeah. to do? You don't know what the fuck to tell the people in Hard Candy. They're both screwed. Another thing that makes me believe his character, even kind of till the end, is part of it is personal denial. Mm-hmm. It really just is me saying, maybe he's a good guy. You don't know. It's like how I have a problem convicting people. You just, the evidence really needs to be overwhelming. Like you pointed out, you don't see the photos. He even makes a point of saying, I do charitable work.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Do you scoff at that, or does that kind of push you in the other way?
I scoff at that completely.
It is silly.
Here's a little personal anecdote. So sure. back in my younger days, I don't know if you knew me. You didn't know me, but you did know this about me.
Okay.
I went to church every fucking week because sure. my mom is a hardcore Catholic.
Exciting.
So I went to church every fucking
week. She doesn't listen to this show, does she?
No. And I went to go pick up this girl from her house a little bit after I had gone to church. I was in high school, and I picked up this girl from her house, and I walked inside, and her mom gets really like nervous because I'm at that time I was not a very safe looking human being, sure. especially for a daughter to be going out with on a Friday night.
Right.
And her mom's like, "Are you going to be safe?" Starts asking me all these questions. I'm like, "Oh no, I've gone to church every week of my life since I was two."
Right.
And she goes, "That doesn't mean anything."
It was this moment of awakening for you.
It's where you realize
you're right.
It doesn't matter.
No,
like,
it doesn't matter at all.
Bad people do good things.
Certainly. They're human beings. So what the story about you raping your girlfriend proves is that people have a wide range of activities they do, whether they're good people or bad people. And I like to believe there aren't really good people or bad people, but good decisions and yeah. bad decisions. I think that's a pretty common idea.
Right.
And these characters are making good and bad right. decisions. And the consequences clearly are of his bad decisions. Right. But she's making a bad decision herself. You know, we see the infamous torture scene, very memorable, unfortunately, scene from this movie. And he's trying to persuade her, you're going to do things in your life that are going to scar you forever. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things. Please, please don't do this. So while I do promise to bring my own nerdy photography shit into this, what you can really bring for me mm-hmm. is your analysis of this Saw-like torture
yeah,
scene.
It's,
because
it's,
it really is,
it
isn't
is.
It?
There's the fluorescent lighting, there's sure. the greens and the sweat,
yep.
and the whining and the begging.
Yes, the whining and the begging
it's
and
all,
the dirt.
It's all there.
Yeah.
There's just this wonderful, odd castration scene, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, it is. It's really Saw-like in nature, especially some of the later Saw films.
Yeah.
The Bousman.
Yeah.
It's just, it's gritty, and you're sweating, you know? You yeah. feel just as uncomfortable, and your hands are just as fucking purple.
Which is odd, because you should, as an audience, if I were just describing how this movie played out, and it's interesting, get different people who have seen this to describe what happens in it to you, and they'll tell you very different stories mm-hmm. about the character's motivations and what's going on. But if I were to just describe to you, okay, this girl's picked up and she finds out that this guy's a pedophile and she decides to save the rest of the world, to save future potential women who may fall victim to him, she's going to castrate him. That sounds like a scene the audience should revel in, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it? They don't revel in that
no.
scene. No one's happy about that.
Well, that's because there's the weird preface about her stalking him, which just makes the whole, it deepens the whole situation.
Right.
It makes him a victim again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then, yeah, there's the castration scene is really long and
yeah,
it's really
sure.
drawn out, and there's conversation, which makes it even worse.
Yeah.
It, I mean, you said it. You said it's like torture porn, but without all the, I guess without, it's without the gore.
Yeah.
Really.
It's without the mask.
Yeah.
If she had a mask over her face,
sure.
and that's really interesting. And maybe the best defense of so-called torture porn is just to tell art house people, you liked Hard Candy.
Yeah.
Because this is a scene that does, you made the Saw parallel, but it could come out of
yeah.
countless movies.
Right.
Basically any of this genre, it's basically
as if you're saying if Juno were to pay to go into one of the rooms at the hostel,
yes,
that's an artistic film.
Well, I think the reason for that is the packaging, because the subject is so upfront, because you know the first second of the first goddamn frame when these two are together what you're looking at. Even from the one sheet, which, by the way, I love one sheets. I've talked about that a little bit before. I'm a big fan of theatrical one sheets. It's the first glimpse you see of what a film's really going to be about. And the theatrical one sheet for Hard Candy is just Haley in the Little Red Riding Hood hoodie and a giant bear trap. And I really love that. But that's all up front. You know what the movie's talking about, and it's a heavy issue. I was waving my hands around in a whatever this is, air quotes. So that allows the film to get away with scenes like this that if they appeared where a person is wearing a mask, they're torture porn. And that's one of the reasons I think we hate torture porn as a
phrase.
I mean, if you want to label it that and you like it, if you want to run around on the street saying, I love torture porn, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I think the whole phrase really just...
To use it as a derogatory term, it's throwing out something that has just as much artistic fucking value as anything else.
Well, we talked about that with films like Hostel 2 that have really thick themes. And even for, you know, season one of the show, year one of the show, when themes was not even a thing on the radar, we still knew there was so much to be discussed about Hostel 2, just like there is in Hard Candy. But Hard Candy gets away with it. Maybe the only thing to pull it back from that a little bit is that there isn't a lot of gore in the scene.
Yeah.
The scene is unusually tense for a scene that doesn't have any gore, and I kind of blame that on the sounds.
Yeah.
All of the squishy meat carving sounds are pretty awful. They're pretty cringeworthy. Really, the only time you see red is when the camera...
pants to the wall.
Yeah, and you get the red wall. You also see red a little bit after the surgery, but you do get...
with the testes and the shot glasses.
Yeah. Beautiful props that she has brought with her. See, she is a vindictive little bitch. She brought these props. That's disgusting. I mean, he's disgusting too, but she is also very...
But she put testicles in a trash.
I'm just saying, she had a lot... She intended to torture this man. This didn't get out of control. His situation, not that I'm defending it in the least, probably got out of control. I mean, he regularly puts himself in situations where he's photographing younger women, so he's a fucking bastard for that. But of course, the situation got out of control, and that's almost definitely what happened. She went there with shot glasses in her bag, with fake testicles in them, with surgical equipment, with a VHS tape. I mean, she had this so planned. Disgusting. And you noted the dialogue, too. He gives this long-winded speech about Aunt Denise. What do you think's the point of that? Why does he do that?
I think he's trying to redeem himself. I don't think he's necessarily trying to say, this is why I'm the way I am, because that's what she asks. But I think he's instead trying to say, this happened early, and I didn't really...
Do you think it's his way of saying accidents happen, or is he just...
I think he's just kind of trying to... say anything that comes to mind. Right. He's trying to make himself more of a human being.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't cut your balls off. I'd be a lot more likely to cut off someone's balls I didn't know, especially if her balls were in my mouth.
Mr. DeRiff, if you could pull your balls out of her mouth for a second. I agree with you completely. Not about the balls thing, but about what he's saying. I think he's trying to make himself appear more human, even if it's just telling a story. It's probably the first thing that entered his mind. I mean, he wasn't exactly being tortured in his story. But it was a story to him of an accident that happened where a girl put herself in a compromising situation and he was punished for it. Sort of like what's happening now. Mm-hmm. Although this is what he did was definitely wrong and that's his fault, unlike his story. But yeah, I think he's trying to reach out and say,
don't cut my balls off.
Yeah, basically, please. I love that too. What would you say? Well, please help me. A girl is cutting my balls off. So what's worse from a horror fan's point of view? The scene where she's cutting his balls off that lasts like 15, 20 minutes, or the scene where she puts them in the garbage disposal?
Honestly, as a horror fan, no.
Does the garbage disposal not bother you?
The garbage disposal for me is feeding the dick to the dog.
Okay,
It's the cutting him off is the, oh, that's awful, and then the feeding it to the dog is where you go, yes, that's what I want to see.
But that's where you become Zack Snyder at that point. Yeah. Yeah, it's the final thing where, and she even says, you know, I could just sew him back in, even though that clearly doesn't make any sense and isn't going to help the situation. It's this one little tiny moment of, oh, maybe we can make this better again. But once she puts him in the garbage disposal and the fucking sound, there's just no turning back. unless she didn't cut them off in the first place. That vindictive little bitch, I'm telling you. And I believe that is our unfortunate segue into me rambling for quite a bit.
Mm.
So I just want to talk to you about some of the artistic merits of this film, if I may, Mr. Kester.
All right, you got, what, 3 minutes?
I'm going to do the best I can. Ambient sound plays a big part in this movie, with the exception of a couple songs, none are by Goldfrapp, that appear in the film. What is the one at the end?
Do you know Elephant Woman by Blonde Redhead.
Yeah, I really enjoy that too. I'm going to have to look some of that stuff up. There's no score. And every time I bitch about score on this show, it seems to be because a movie like Jurassic Park, for instance, I remember I bitched about because it's John Williams and everyone loves him. And a score like the refrigerator's buzzing in Hard Candy wouldn't quite fit in Jurassic Park. So maybe this is just a terrible premise to start with. But when I complain about over-orchestrated scores, a movie like Hard Candy does something I think is really interesting that I wish more movies replaced their score with. It uses ambient sound. It uses lots of buzzes and humming. Sometimes they crescendo right before a scene changes, and sometimes they're just in the very background. I won't say too much about the sound because I think if you just go back through the movie and listen to it, you'll pick up a lot of what's interesting about it. But I did want to propose it as an alternative to giant score. I think this is a really interesting movie to listen to using headphones, to go back and watch it using headphones and see how the scenes play out. As a nerdy photography person, I also love the way this movie looks. First thing we have talked about before, and it's an interesting use of this, is the 45-degree shutter, which is combined with a couple different things. We talked about it the most in 28 Weeks Later, where they used a variety of techniques to accomplish the way the zombies looked. Sorry, the infected looked, as Danny Boyle would scold me for not saying. Here it's just the 45-degree shutter that's used, but we see it when the drugs first hit him. We see it quite a bit in the beginning of the film, actually. In that great scene where they manipulate the audio of her voice to sound all chopped up and basically fucked like the audio in our intro sounds. We see it when he sprayed in the mouth. If you want a great example of 45-degree shutter that isn't in Russell Crowe's Gladiator, go to this movie and look at the scene where he sprayed in the mouth. What the 45-degree shutter does is emulates a very, very high shutter speed so that you don't get any motion blur in each of the frames that makes up the moving picture that is the film. You could also accomplish something similar by just blasting the set with light and then actually using a high shutter speed, but that takes a lot of goddamn light and it can make your picture look a little weird. It's not the exact same effect. So you get to see the mist of the spray. You get to move the camera around a lot, which is something the 45-degree shutter is used for very often, and you don't get any motion blur. It just gives things a very uneasy feeling, and it's very important in a film like Hard Candy where you don't have score to tell you, you don't have like pounding drums to tell you that something important is happening and that there's action. Really, all you have is the sounds of them grunting, the toaster oven kicking on in the background, and 45-degree shutter shaking all over the goddamn place. Also really extensive and effective use when she's tearing through the apartment looking for the pornography. A lot of stuff, absolutely no blur, very clean. Or in a variety of other scenes where the characters are assaulting one another. The color is really intentional in a lot of the scenes too. I think you first notice it as a casual viewer when you see his setup, his studio for doing photography. When she walks in and he has the giant pull-downs of color. Different rooms have different color. They're lit in a very specific way where the color is very saturated. Even the opening scenes, the Nighthawk scenes, where you don't have, you know, they're outside his apartment, so they can't just be one color. They're not as simple and minimalistic as his apartment is. They're a lot warmer. They're meant to make the audience feel safer visually, but with all of the disturbing stuff going on, the audience still feels very upset, which just shows how effective the dialogue and their performances are. When you get back to his apartment, rarely have I seen movies that are so well lit. It's really gorgeous. You have the backgrounds that are lit very evenly, and then the characters' faces are lit in a way that accentuates their shadows a lot, really separates them from the background. It's very cool. That set design does help. It's the fact that it's really simple. You see a lot of vertical lines used. I'm not going to go through and point out every time it's used everywhere, but we talked about it with the torture scene. Mm-hmm. You can pull back to red. You can see a lot of the separations between different rooms that resemble different moods. His bedroom being the one that started being the safest. It's pink. It's fucking pink.
Right.
You know, you should feel the safest there until she's pulling things apart and finds the gun there. The kitchen becomes a really, really dangerous area. That first spot where she's spraying him in the mouth and all of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek lens flares going on all over the place. And then just one more thing to make the characters even more intense is a lot of use of close-ups. not even just their faces, but parts of their faces. You get close-ups of their eyes, close-ups of their mouth, and using a very, very shallow depth of field. So all that's in focus are the eyes, are the mouth, are the parts you're supposed to be looking at. Everything from their ears back, totally blurry. And some of the scenes even make use of that kind of blurring to transition from one to another. The camera tells you exactly where to stay and make sure you feel that one-on-one connection that the two characters feel as an audience member.
All right, Eric, you're boring everybody. Let's try to have some more fun.
I don't know of a more fun time than sitting down and watching funny games.
I can't think of one either, except maybe stabbing myself in the balls with a needle.
If you're looking for more fun, I think any other show we've ever done, any other film, maybe with the exception of Pie.
Oh my god. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. While Michael regains consciousness and picks himself up off the floor, we get our intro music, which I think is the most telling piece of the entire... Maybe it's just because the intro music is such a reveal.
The Zen music.
Yeah, the Zen music. We talked about the intro music already when we talked about the Attic Expeditions, where Jeremy Kasten somehow found it first and would like to claim rights to that.
Mm-hmm.
They're strolling along on the country road, going to their vacation home. They're putting on... And the movie draws you to the music. It's like, hey, listen to this CD. No, you know what? Let's listen to this CD. Are your ears paying attention to the classical music? And then fucking Funny Games pops up, and the Zen music kicks in, as we joke about from Children of Men, sounding very much like the Children of Men Zen music. And it lets you know what, there's something wrong about this movie, mm-hmm. and you're going to fucking suffer for an hour and a half. Enjoy your time here. So I don't know about the first time you saw it, but I didn't know a whole lot about it going in. I know this is the second time, because I haven't been able to bring myself to watch it again. But all I had seen is the poster, which is Naomi Watts, executive producer and star of the film, crying.
Well, it's the scene
very
when she's,
hard.
It's the scene when she's sitting on the couch.
Yeah.
Right when they start talking about whether or not she's fit or has jelly rolls.
Yeah, talk about a good one sheet. I mean, it's a frame from the movie, and it captures exactly what's going to happen so well. So you know that it has some sort of, maybe horror is the wrong word, but something very bad is going to happen in this film. But what's unusual, and back when we were deep into year one, I noticed this especially, we don't really have any scare shots here.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole time this movie, and this says something about the pacing as well, the whole time the movie's starting, they're driving around, with the exception maybe of the opening music, there's nothing that has really jarred you. And you get in the house, and from that first frame, I'm waiting for something to jump out and stab me in the face. Even just the opening shot, I always remember too, of when they're in the house and the dog goes up the stairs and it's just sitting there. And you say to yourself, why are we sitting here? What's going to happen? It drives me nuts. Pacing is probably one of the most important things the film does.
Absolutely.
A side effect of that, I think, is you start looking for clues almost.
Yeah.
You want to know, where is this going? What's going to happen? You're immediately grasping for details the best you can. You notice something just about Naomi Watts' first activity in the apartment.
Yeah, in the opening scene where she's in the kitchen, she's washing lettuce.
Yeah.
I mean, normally, I wouldn't even notice that a character is washing lettuce.
Sure.
But the fact that
you're
nothing
around,
else is going on,
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen. I mean, I've seen
no
the film.
No music, nothing's happening.
You're
but
just
still,
trying to grasp
sure.
something. You're trying to get a hold on anything.
Yeah.
And she's washing lettuce. I go, that is the perfect thing for her to be doing.
Sure.
She's the type of person that washes lettuce. This is the type of family that fucking washes lettuce. Because you never really know any of the characters.
No, you don't.
You don't get introduced to them.
No.
They just show up and they do what they do. And you're just left with that. They kind of throw characters at you and you go, all right, this is what they're doing. That's how you know them.
So she wants to be safe. She wants to be predictable. She's on her family vacation, really. I mean, it's a vacation home, mm-hmm. essentially, which always struck me as really scary because there are these giant houses that you just leave unattended for three seasons out of the year. And when you enter them, they're dark and alone and frightening. It's supposed to be a welcoming environment, but it's also very foreign. The kitchen kind of points out another thing that that is just screaming my name as I'm watching this movie, saying, hey, look at me over here. You're staring at the lettuce. I'm staring at all the doors and windows the entire time. We're in the kitchen, and there is really only, besides the window to the side, there is one entrance to the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when our guest comes in,
right?
When the first of the two boys comes in asking for eggs, I kind of know this is the outsider. This is where the trouble is going to begin. And so every time the camera pans away, I'm just ready for him to come back and smack her with a bat or something.
Right.
Something really abrasive.
Turn into
something
a werewolf.
Really, something, yeah. Maybe it's just I've been doing too many movies on this show. and the pace is just very slow. It's very deliberate. It's going to get there when it wants to get
it's
there.
It's gradual as fuck.
Yeah, it really is.
Just, I mean,
the I think that's beautiful.
The escalation is so slow.
Sure,
the
sure.
The first time that you even sense that something may be wrong, mm-hmm. like the first evidence you get other than this feels wrong,
right?
You get him dropping the eggs and going, oh, I need more now.
Yeah.
And she says, well, you dropped them. And he says, well, you have enough. Can I just have
unless
them?
I'm mistaken, yeah. there are 12. You could spare another four.
He shows a little bit of he's a little bit too assertive with asking for the favor.
Sure.
He kind of goes, well, okay, thanks for those eggs. I dropped them. You should just give me more, though.
Yes, yes. It's interesting, though, as you were searching your head for the word assertive, the words that come to my mind are, you know, humble, reserved, apologetic, because, and these two are really strange characters in that way. They're not the aggressors. They're not even wolves in sheep's clothing. They're just concerned with rules and with politeness. And that guy is not leaving that apartment without some fucking eggs, but he's going to ask really, really nicely for them. Aggressively, but really, really nicely, to the point where you have no idea what to make of these guys. You don't know what they want. One of the other things the pacing does by slowing down is it allows each activity that happens to have so much more of an impact. You know, so many times when we see horror movies, they get to the gore. They're so anxious to get to the gore.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to know, hey, this is going to be bloody. Don't worry. We're getting there. You know, there's going to be people's eyes flying out of heads and bunny rabbits getting run over. And we're going to get to the splatterfest. But Funny Games wants you to know that every dropped egg has huge implications. Mm-hmm. It's a big fucking problem. When Tim Roth's character first gets hit with that golf club, that is a problem for basically the rest of the movie.
It becomes
blood doesn't spray all over the right. walls, but you know the
it
tension
becomes
has
the
been
most
building.
Serious issue.
Sure,
everything
absolutely.
Everything comes
as it should be.
Everything comes back to the fact that this guy is maimed beyond motion, and he's weak, and he should be the strongest character here.
Yeah,
he's the one
you're hoping
the captain
to save
of
them.
The family.
Yes,
and he's Tim Roth. I mean, come on, Tim Roth is supposed to come into play as the badass, or at least stand up.
Yes,
he's got attitude. But he's been maimed right away, and you're left with a child and a woman who washes fucking lettuce.
Yeah, the lettuce washer is not about to save them all. So I think the pace allows you to examine the repercussions of each action. The other thing it does is, you know, once you get to the violence, once you're hacking off limbs within the first act, where do you really go from there? I mean, of course, there's other things to do, and we've talked countless times on the show about ways they continue to push the envelope. But when it takes you half of the way through the film to really get to where that family's starting to be tortured, man, do you feel that a lot more. As soon as things heat up and they get into the other room where, you know, they're on the couch and where a lot of the film takes place, you start to ask yourself why. Why is a really interesting question to me, and one that the film addresses, I would say, about 10 or 15 minutes after you really start going, okay, we've seen the immediate danger. We can't really think about why during the egg scene. Mm-hmm. We're still focused on what the fuck are they doing. But once they've gotten on the couch and Tim Roth is injured and everybody is really upset, you start to say, well, what are they doing? They run through a lot of essentially red herrings, a sort of misdirection. They're playing fucking games with these people. What do you think is the reason? I mean, the film's begging you to kind of go, what is happening?
I think it's the title.
Yeah?
I think the title is the answer. I honestly
they're amusing
think
themselves?
They're doing it because they're having a good time. I mean, the thing you have to ask yourself, and I found myself asking myself this.
Really?
When they leave for that brief period of time after they shoot the little boy,
yes.
Where do they go and how are they acting toward each other? Do you think that when they're not on screen, they're like you and I? Or do you think that when they're not on screen, they're still acting really proper and making sure that they're polite, and they probably just ran to the store because they were thirsty for some fucking Fiji water?
Yeah, it's...
Or are they like, dude, you fucking shot that kid. That was awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I think whatever their motivation is, it's clearly not robbery. It's not self-interest. So I don't think they're thinking about their plan at all, really.
Right.
We see from the end of the movie in the small lapse, really, between what happens to Naomi Watts' character and when they encounter their next victims.
Yeah, well, the
right?
third house that we know of
yeah,
that, they,
yeah.
that they're going to hit.
In that small period, they're really just talking to themselves in the same manner. And for me, even though all the characters are dead, that's one of the scariest points, because when you finally get to hang out with the killers for the first time and see what they are like outside of other people, when they're not putting on a show, they're doing the same thing. They're not putting on a show. This is who they are. But that question of where did they go is really interesting. And I think maybe one of the most haunting things about Funny Games is that it leaves you with so many questions. You know, they could make another film entirely, although I'm certain they wouldn't, about what these kids did before they came to this house. Mm-hmm. What the last house was like, because we see a lot of remnants of that, although we don't really explore that.
There's this really weird moment the first time you see Michael Pitt's character, Jerry.
Yes.
When you first see him walk through the gate with the neighbor where everybody's in the weird monotone clothing.
Yes.
And the neighbor's all dressed in blue.
Yeah.
He's uncomfortable.
Yeah, he is.
He's not. I mean, it's very clear that he's already in a dangerous situation
for sure.
with these boys. And probably Michael Pitt says, take me over, introduce me to them. Tom's going to stay here and shoot your wife.
Yeah, basically. Well, he doesn't even have to threaten them in the beginning. When Naomi Watts runs into some other characters, we start to see what it might be like or what it may have been like before that family.
Exactly.
He doesn't even have to say anything. He says, we're both thinking the same thing, aren't we? And that's enough to frighten her into behaving, essentially. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the movie is about invasion. It's about intrusion. These characters coming into a place they're not invited. I think that's also largely what the film does to its audience. It's trying to make you, it's sort of in the same way as Hard Candy, as fucking uncomfortable as possible. One of the ways it does that is to break the fourth wall. That seems like something you would not be okay with, so I'm curious about your take on that.
The first time I saw it, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
But after a while, I mean, I've seen it about 4 or 5 times now.
Sure.
And now I not only do I accept it as part of the film, but it's what I look forward to.
Yeah, yeah.
It's partially because it's a relief from the film,
sure.
from what's going on.
Right.
But also because I feel like it's so necessary for you as an audience to realize that the characters are doing it as if there's an audience. They're
yes.
doing it to keep an audience in mind. They're doing it to please, whether it's a fictional audience in their brain.
Yeah.
You know, to keep with a global rule.
Yes.
That's what they're doing. They're trying to follow rules. They're trying to follow social niceties. And I think that that's illustrated perfectly when he turns to the audience and just nods, winks, whatever.
Sure.
Says, these people are, look at these people. Like,
yeah.
Right?
What yeah. are? There's two examples where it's really obvious, but you mentioned sort of nods and winks. My second time through it, I picked up on a lot of stuff where he just sort of turns at the camera in the middle of a take. Or even the beginning scene where he just kind of looks back in our direction and looks forward. We don't really know if he's looking at us or not. But I definitely think that's part of that overall theme of intrusion. They're intruding beyond the fourth mm-hmm. wall. They're intruding on the audience. Another thing that does is helps with the brutality of the film. You know, from the very first kill, which is completely, you kill the kid first. Even our beloved splatter films won't do that.
The best part about that scene is you get the counting.
Yes.
He starts counting, and he's counting, and he's pointing. And
more
he gets
rules.
He gets up to maybe 6.
Sure.
And then the camera follows Jerry into the kitchen.
Yeah.
But if you're counting in your head, it lands on the boy. I did that. I just
really?
Followed counting. I was like, okay, well, Naomi.
Sure, sure.
Kid, Tim Roth, and continued. And I realized that 35 ends on the boy. And you hear the gunshot as
sure.
soon as you count to 35.
Sure.
I mean, if you count the same pace as Tom, 35
yeah.
gunshot.
The flip side of that is he's still making a sandwich or whatever the fuck. These guys are always eating. He's back in the kitchen. He's preparing food, and it's mundane for him. The gunshot goes off, and there's a brief moment where he goes, oh, that's interesting. Wonder what happened over in the other room there. But he continues making his goddamn sandwich. This doesn't bother him at all. They treat the kills as completely mundane. And when they talk to the family about what's going to happen, there's never intonation in their voice. They don't care about these kills at all outside of amusing themselves. But to get back to the fourth wall thing, that's part of not appeasing the characters. There's
mm-hmm.
nothing you can do. The film is relentless and you're not going to get away from it. And there are little moments throughout the film, see if you can spot them all upon rewatching, where they try to give you hope, but they immediately
mm-hmm.
take it away.
Well, the clearest one is the rewinding scene.
Yeah.
Which I don't want to get into ad nauseum because I
sure.
think it speaks really strongly for itself.
Yes.
But one thing I really want to point out about the rewinding scene, and I don't
mm-hmm.
want to get it confused because we brought it up when we did, but this isn't breaking the fourth wall. He doesn't actually turn to the camera and say anything.
Right.
This is kind of a...
It acknowledges a sort of mechanism
It's a
there.
Bent of reality.
Yes.
That goes... It's like Clue, you know? Could have ended this way, but it didn't.
And I don't think you would get a whole lot of argument about Clue breaking the fourth wall. But for me, that says There's no hope. They'll rewind. These guys can bend space and time. They can do anything they want. They're out to amuse themselves. This family, even if they get away, even if the cops show up, they're just going to rewind it back. Mm-hmm. So you're just going to have to watch these people suffer.
That's the moment where you realize that this is just going exactly the way they want it to go.
Yes.
That there is no outside control. There is no outside
variance. They make fun of
the
audience. When they turn to the audience, they make fun of us for wanting it to go a different way.
It's the moment where you realize that they control all variables and it's going to end before 9 a.m. Everyone will be dead.
The one last time you get some hope, and I feel like they're really pouring it on, which I enjoy a lot. They're in the boat. And he says to him, they're talking about, you know, the mast is swinging around. Mm-hmm. It's a mast, right? I've never been on a fucking boat. I don't know what I'm talking about. And he says to him, you know, they use the names Beavis and Butthead and Tom and Jerry. I like that a lot. Be careful. I mean, you're going to injure yourself. And you kind of go, oh, maybe there's hope there. And then he says this strange thing. He goes, you said you can't swim, right? And there's another moment where you go, okay, he's going to knock himself in the water. She's going to swim away to safety. Everything's going to be fine. And before you even complete that thought, they look at the clock and then they just push her off the boat. Mm-hmm. Fucking done. Nothing you can do about it. And I sat in my seat the first time I saw that and I just said, this can't be it. What the fuck? And while you're, again, it's stages of grief, you know, it's a little bit of denial. And then they carry on their conversation about parallel universes
and
or
time space,
whatever the hell is going on. And they get to the dock and you say to yourself, that's it. And for a film that has been about tension the entire way, they get to the very end, he stares into the camera, another sort of great fourth wall thing, and I get what, at least for me, was the first scare shot of the entire film.
Where they bring the music back?
Where the logo comes up, and I'm so terrified because he's looking at me, and I'm like, we're going to get our last revelation. He's going to say something about the Naomi Watts thing. Something's going to happen. There's going to be a little bit of hope. Scary music. That's it. That's all I get. Scary music, and it freaks me out, and I love it. We have a website, of course. It's doublefeatureshow.com. You can send us an email. Use doublefeatureshow@gmail.com is the email address. What should people email us about this week?
Naked pictures is my default, man.
Yeah, I'll just go back to naked photos.
Yeah.
If you're over 18, though, we don't need any weird Ellen Page situations here. We got two things coming up on the show the very next week, actually. This time next week, I believe.
Yeah, we're going to cover Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and Fight Club.
What, Fight Club? How did that get on the schedule?
I don't know. I think it was
Did you put that on there?
Typo. It was supposed to be Club Dread.
Oh. I'm going to have to call up and fire our producer. Can you fire the producer? Do you know any? Can we like form a union? How does that work?
Yeah, we'll form a firing union. Or that's a firing squad. Sorry.
I don't know how much more of you I can take.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.